That's Johnny Hodges on alto sax, with Wild Bill Davis on organ, with Joe's Blues, also featuring Grant Green on guitar, Lawrence Brown on trombone, Bob Bushnell on Fender bass, and Grady Tate on drums. Recorded, by the way, in 1965. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, December the 18th. And the two issues I'm going to be talking about today are issues that I said would happen. And they in fact have happened. Edward Snowden took a trip down Vladimir Putin way, it seems, and decided to go directly to the people of Brazil via a newspaper appeal for asylum in their country. But we have a leading whistleblower, founder of a whistleblowers coalition, who says that he ought to answer 8 questions right now, and his credibility, she says, rests upon it. But first, we're going to be talking about a huge problem with Obamacare. I told you would arise, and yes, it has. It's about to crash land on more than 5 million people, most of them people of color. The president and the first lady yesterday re-engaged, because now this is a whole big PR effort. So they're re-engaging, that's the word the White House used, to describe this newfound PR campaign. They re-engaged with presumably middle-class people, because they don't re-engage with, they don't re-engage with the working poor or the poor. So it is to be assumed these were with middle-class moms to extol the benefits of Obamacare. But a very disturbing thing is that a report surfaced yesterday by the Kaiser Family Foundation that did a comprehensive study on Obamacare and the uninsured, and the report found that 5 million Americans fall into a no man's land, and they will not be covered by Obamacare. Why? Because they live in 25 states whose governors have rejected federal aid to expand their Medicaid subsidies. I don't know if you recall, I made a big thing about that, saying that is going to be a huge problem, because with them shutting the door on Medicaid funds, it means that poor people have no way of paying the premiums. And these are significant states. Well, let me tell you a little bit about what the report says. The report says that these about 5 million people overwhelmingly are African American and Latino. And they come from the states, as I said, that are rejecting Medicaid funds. This does not include large populations of undocumented people, because in any event, they will be deemed ineligible, and they are ineligible for Medicaid. So even so, it is a very startling number, 5 million people. Now, how could the Obama administration not have seen it? I mean, I saw it. It was logical, because they said they published a list of the states that will be expanding. That's what they did. It's just, I mean, you wonder, what could they be thinking? If you publish a list of states that are expanding Medicaid, obviously anybody on the list is not expanding Medicaid. And we know now that 25 states are not going to be expanding Medicaid. And I'll go down the list alphabetically. The states are Alabama, Alaska, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Indiana, Kansas, Louisiana, Maine, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Virginia, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. Now, what this report finds is that overwhelmingly, well, let me read you from the report. The characteristics of the population that falls into the coverage gap largely mirror those of poor, uninsured adults. For example, because racial and ethnic minorities are more likely than white non-Hispanics to lack insurance coverage and are more likely to live in families with low incomes, they are disproportionately represented among poor, uninsured adults and among people in the coverage gap. Nationally, says the report, about half, 47% of uninsured adults in the coverage gap are white non-Hispanics, 21% are Hispanic, and 27% are black. However, the race and ethnicity of people in the coverage gap also reflects differences in the racial and ethnic composition between states moving forward with the Medicaid expansion and states not planning to expand. Several states that have Hispanic populations, for example, California, New York, and Arizona, are moving forward with the expansion, while other states with large black populations, for example, Florida, Georgia, and Texas, are not. As a result, says the report, blacks account for a slightly higher share of people in the coverage gap compared to the total poor adult uninsured population, while Hispanics account for a slightly lower share. This is devastating, considering that Obamacare is the law. You have 5 million people, and this is not something that has just crept up. I saw it coming the day they published the list of states that will be expanding Medicaid, and was able to deduce, very simple math, the states that are not expanding Medicaid. And you can see that even back then, this was, I believe, in October, I talked about this. This was going to be a problem. And here it is. And yet the president yesterday and the first lady yesterday, and they're going to be going on shows, you know, with Al Sharpton and, you know, the black shows. They're going to go taking the Chitlin circuit of radio. And they'll be talking about the great things that Obamacare will be doing. Nobody yet has, I mean, advanced an idea of what will happen to these 5 million people. What are they supposed to do? What are they supposed to do? Haven't heard a thing from the Obama administration about it. Haven't heard a thing from the Congressional Black Caucus who are fighting to say that, you know, yes, it's Obamacare has a lot of problems, but we ought to support it and give it our best and give the president some kind of credibility and give him time to work out these little kinks. But they're talking about a website. I'm talking about people's lives. 5 million people. 47% of them are white, 27% of them are black, 21% of them are Latino, 5% are categorized as other. The vast majority of these people will be between 35 and 54 years old, and that accounts for 37% across the board, 37% of people in this age group. The next largest group would be people 25 to 34 years of age, that's 26%. People 19 to 24 years old, 24%. And the smallest group so far would be 55 to 64 because Medicare kicks in after that. So people 55 to 64, or 14% of the 5 million people affected, would be in the 55 to 64 year old age category. What do you say about an administration that could spot the problems? Of course, people descended on the administration around this awful website and how much money it has cost and the time it has cost and all of this. It has responded to, little kinks. Okay, well, the business sector has objected to a particular tax issue, and they said, okay, we'll delay that, and it will kick in 1 year later. You get time on that, and they're doing these things. Nobody has said a word, and I've been talking. I mentioned it in October. I said this is going to be a huge problem. A huge problem, and here it is. And isn't it odd? It's the same thing over and over again. We live in this society that is so awfully race-based that it is almost a kind of instinctive reaction. Whenever you hear something like this, whenever you hear these kinds of reports, you know intuitively that if there is some kind of a thing that is just not working well or will not work well, you can always bet that poor people, working poor people, and so-called minorities are the people who are going to get shafted more than anybody else. And so said, so done. How is this possible? And why is it that the president has said nothing so far? This is a question. How could you not have spotted this? Or if you did spot this, and if it was shaping up to be a problem, why did it go unaddressed? It actually still has gone unaddressed. The Bloomberg Business Week is the first place that published the story. Bloomberg Business. And we know why. They're publishing this from a point of view that, there's a huge business impact this would have. But the story, this should have been the story of the day. 5 million people. These are not figments of anybody's imagination. This is not something that is being conjectured. This is a fact. These are real people with real lives. These are people who, even because they're poor, deserve a greater consideration because they are completely at risk. Simply because of geography, they're not supposed to enjoy the same rights and privileges of other people, perhaps in the next door state, that are being covered. This is a kind of thing. I talked about zero-sum thinking, and this administration is just riddled with it. It's swimming in it. The idea that anything that can be described as a strategic resource, and I told you that healthcare is one of these things. Healthcare is one of these strategic resources in our society. The first thing is that there isn't supposed to be enough for everybody. Not everybody should be able to enjoy it or have access to it. Because if everybody had access to healthcare, you're creating something this country cannot stand. Philosophically, it is, of course, it promotes the idea. But in practical terms, it just hates the idea of equality. It hates the idea that everybody could live a decent life. It lives by this mercenary philosophy that there are those who should have, and they should have because they pull themselves up by their bootstraps and they seek opportunity and they work hard, as this president continues to say. They work hard. These are middle-class people, the people he's devoted to. 5 million people, as the year ends, have no answers about the access to health care, nor do they have answers about how they're going to pay a fine? Because part of the law is if you don't buy health insurance, you are a criminal. You will pay a fine. So he has criminalized this entire segment, and I'm willing to bet you that this is a huge part of his political base. This is a president who has absolutely no care about that. No sense of loyalty, no sense of obligation. And this push by the Clintonite he has brought on to conduct this PR campaign as if this were, you know, you're rolling out a new car or a new model of some, you know, updated version of an iPhone or something. And what you want is to do the message and the branding and all the other proverbial advertising tricks of the trade to get people to buy in psychologically to this. This is real life. 5 million people is real life. Here's what the report says. In states that do not expand Medicaid, millions of poor adults will be left without a new coverage option, particularly poor, uninsured black adults residing in the South, where most states are not moving forward with the expansion. 4 in 10 uninsured blacks with incomes low enough to qualify for the Medicaid expansion fall into the gap, compared to 24% of uninsured Hispanics and 29% of uninsured whites. These continued coverage gaps will likely lead to widening racial and ethnic as well as geographic disparities in coverage and access. There is no way that anybody could tell me that this administration didn't know this. There is no way that anybody could tell me that, okay, maybe they overlooked it originally, but they had no way of knowing now. They know this. If I could just, anybody could just understand, since going back to October, and perhaps even earlier than that, that was my revelation in October, that this is going to be a problem. I had no idea it was going to be 5 million people, but you can tell that it was going to have serious ramifications because the states that had rejected Medicare, because the Supreme Court, the same court that made Obamacare the law, also said that the states have an option that they could exercise. The states cannot be compelled to expand Medicaid. It was their decision. It was states' rights. And half of the country, half of the nation said, we are not going to do it. Which is to say, we don't care about the poor. We're not going to be part of this. We do not care what happens to them. That's not our job. The reason they are poor is because they don't have ambition, for the most part. They don't want to work hard, and they don't want to lift themselves out of poverty. And we're not going to spend our state tax dollars to subsidize poor people. In fact, of course, a huge percentage of that population is children. There is no care. So I'm waiting to see when President Obama and his health czar, Madam Sebelius, will actually become aware that it would actually register on them that there's a problem here. And somebody better have answers as the year winds down. Somebody better have answers about what is supposed to happen to 5 million people who are in this position, that they are poor, they will not be able to afford premiums, they are not going to be getting subsidies from their states because the states say, we don't care about you, we don't care about this, this is not We don't have money to do this kind of nonsense, and we don't want Obamacare anyway. We don't like it. We don't want it. Who is supposed to solve the problem? Who is supposed to solve this problem? That's what we're waiting for. And why is it that every time we talk about something like this, it is automatically assumed, somehow it always works out this way, that poor people, working poor people, and certainly African Americans, Native Americans, Latino Americans are at the absolute bottom rung of the economic ladder. They always get shafted. We take this little break, come back to Mr. Snowden right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead, and we're about to talk about Mr. Edward Snowden. Mr. Snowden, as you know, is in Russia. And I guess he tore a page out of Vladimir Putin's book. You recall that Putin, when the U.S. was negotiating as part of a group of nations to bring this Syria issue to some kind of manageable close, Putin published an op-ed piece in the New York Times. And it took the thunder away from the Obama administration on that score. Well, Mr. Snowden apparently followed suit and thought that, well, Putin can do it. I like Putin. I could do it too. So he wrote a letter titled A Letter to the People of Brazil. And it was published. And in that letter, he makes the case that he ought to be given asylum in Brazil, because after all, he's for transparency, he's against government surveillance, and he can assist the government of Brazil, or Dilma, he calls it. He can assist Dilma. I mean, he actually said Dilma, not President Rousseff, but Dilma. I could assist Dilma just hunting down the ways in which the security systems of Brazil are open to infection and capture by U.S. forces and all of that stuff. I'm not going to read the whole letter. You should get a copy of it and read it, though, but it's, you know, he's speaking, as I said, these people, Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, they fashion themselves, they believe themselves to be on par with world leaders, so they act like world leaders. And so he is functioning as a world leader. He's making a statement, speaking directly to the Brazilian people. You will recall from the very beginning, I said, there is too much about this guy that is not known. And rather than jump into the Ed Snowden fan club, you know, with both feet, he needs to answer some questions. We need to find out who he is, who he's working for, who he answers to, what is being done with this information, a whole bunch of questions. But mostly, there's something here that is absolutely rotten. And we are discovering that through a woman named Sybil Edmonds, who happens to be the founder of the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. She was a former FBI translator, and she had herself been a whistleblower and suffered mightily for it. She wrote the book Classified Woman, The Sybil Edmonds Story. And I was quoting, because she's not making any press statements, she says, I was quoting from her blog that she publishes, titled The Boiling Frog's Post. And she had exposed before, in two separate entries, that the information that Mr. Snowden stole from the NSA is at the center of a multi-million dollar business. most prominently involving Glenn Greenwald, the reporter, quote, I use that term loosely, who has been writing about these stories for The Guardian in London, and for a woman named Laura Poitras, who is a documentarian, and Sybil Edmonds had alleged that both Greenwald and Poitras have basically entered these business arrangements predicated on these documents stolen by Snowden. The question is, does he know? Is he part of it? We don't know. But in any event, he has some questions to answer. I'll get to these questions in a minute. But first, I want to talk about Mr. Snowden himself and how this works out. I mean, it's so predictable. The arrogance of people. He, by writing this letter, and of course making sure that it got published, one, just absolutely doesn't care what this causes internally, the political issues that this would cause within Brazil, that doesn't deserve it. And of course, it will cause, he wrote it with the intent, the absolute intent, you don't have to guess at this, the absolute intent was to put the president, President Rousseff, on the defensive. Now she is going to be made to address an American citizen with no history of involvement in anything, who stole government records, and now the entire nation of Brazil is now going to be involved in discussing his asylum as if he's that important. He isn't. It will now create for the president a new layer of political problems because she's being attacked, she's not being radical enough, people are saying she's too moderate and whatnot. But there's also something very important to pay attention to. Glenn Greenwald and his life partner, who is Brazilian, are living in Brazil. Brazil, under President Rousseff, when this whole thing became known about the NSA spying, and it's not like they didn't know. They certainly did not know the extent of it, I keep saying. It's not like this is news. What is news is the extent of it, the sheer volume of it. And there's a reason that we have such unprecedented volume of surveillance. And it's because people like Snowden and the technocracy, the people who are part of that oligarchy, who have made billions of dollars actually fulfilling the government's desire to fashion a very efficient surveillance machine. They built it. They had no problem constructing it. And you would notice the last thing Snowden is willing to criticize is that very group, the group that he belongs to, the people who had no problems receiving hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to construct the most efficient surveillance machinery for the government. It paid very nicely. And now they come with this false piety, this righteousness. Oh, the government, look what the government is doing. It's like, you know, a guy who builds scaffolds, a very nice set of scaffolds, and then becomes alarmed that they're being used to hang people. You know full well that that sector is the sector that gave us the security state. These are the people who built it. They made billions of dollars at it. They did everything the government asked them to do, including cooperate and hand over their records. So when they start up with this, oh, well, you know, we people deserve privacy and all that, didn't you think about that when you were making money building this thing? For all the years and all the expertise you brought to make sure that this thing can do exactly what the government wants it to do, you programmed it, you constructed it, you had no problem taking the money. And you notice Mr. Snowden, as I said, he was able to acquire wealth while he was stealing the documents. He was able to buy a home, which many people can't do, even up until their 60s. He was able to live nicely all around the world at the expense of the government. He lacked for nothing. He lived nicely in Hawaii. He has not returned one red cent, nor has he disavowed all that money, handed it over, saying, I reject this money, this blood money. I won't have a penny of it. No, sir. So, he has the temerity now to create, because I know people like this. Some of them now have their own network. They create this kind of internal conflagration. And at the end, I mean, if they were paid by the CIA, they couldn't be more efficient about it, to create chaos. His thing is, I'm going to be in Brazil, whether one way or the other, if I have to destroy a political system, if I have to create havoc, where the Brazilians ought to be, you know, attending to their affairs and their business. And one of the things that this president has decided to do was to remove all of the servers that serve Brazil out of the United States. He has already said that, to construct their own system. And I fully suspect that Brazil is attractive because, hey, if I could show you where you are vulnerable, certainly I could build the system for you, me and my guys. The arrogance. But it's money. Money. It's not about some guy who suddenly has this pang of conscience. He had no conscience. His father detested, his father was in the Coast Guard, detested the idea that they should regard Barack Obama as a commander-in-chief. I get all of the implications of that. But this guy is no saint. And, as Ms. Edmonds says, of whistleblowers, the whistleblower coalition, there are some questions he needs to answer, and he needs to answer them quick. Writing today, what are those questions, she says? Well, let me read them to you. Let me just get them here. I had them. She says, in the headline of her posting today, Mr. Snowden, it's time to come out and take a stand publicly as to your intentions. I'll read you the preface. A week ago, I began writing a series of commentaries on significant consequences and conflicts of interest associated with Glenn Greenwald, his new PayPal billionaire boss, that is a man by the name of Ardial. I'll get the name Omidyar. I keep saying Ardial. Pierre Omidyar, who owns PayPal, which is owned by eBay, which he also owns, and which made him a billionaire at the age of 31. He says, in my series, I solely focused on serious ethical questions and consequential conflicts of interest matters that have remained unasked and unanswered with regard to the recent joint venture between Greenwald, that's the supposed reporter, and Omidyar, that is Mr. PayPal, the billionaire. Dubious and lucrative book and movie deals with mainstream corporations under the premise of exclusive document release, and our government's sudden and unexplained change in its stand and modus operandi. Up until this point, I have left the topic of Mr. Snowden pretty much untouched, and here is why. To date, after 6 months of intense and nonstop mainstream media coverage of the Snowden NSA topic, very little is known about Mr. Snowden himself. And this includes his real intentions and objectives, the nature and details of his deals and agreements with members of the press, including those made with Glenn Greenwald, and his position on the latest developments, which include the exclusive business deal struck between Greenwald and billionaire Omidyar, million-dollar book and movie deals made based on exclusive publication of some of the leaked documents, and the highly mysterious change of position in the government's stand and response in the midst of all the publicity and commoditization of the controversial leaked NSA cache. Now, she's referring to the fact that they started floating this idea that maybe, you know, the United States should give him amnesty and trade it off for the materials that he has. And that was quickly shot down by the Obama administration, saying that they, in fact, intend to pursue charges against him. I continue. During the past 6 months, I have asked more than 100 times, I've been asked, sorry, more than 100 times by the media and general public where I stand on this Snowden NSA case. My response up until this point so far has been rather vague and generalized. She says, I consider whistleblowers who risk everything to raise public awareness and publicize criminality heroes. True heroes. I have always admired and supported real whistleblowers, those who have sacrificed and put everything at risk for the public's benefit, good, and people's right to know. These courageous individuals need our support and backing. As for Mr. Snowden, for me, it is still too early to form a concrete opinion or pass judgment because there is so much we don't know due to intentional efforts to withhold, obscure, spin, commoditize, and misuse the involved facts. Only Mr. Snowden's public stand and his clear statement in response to the recent convoluted developments can clarify these issues and questions and bring out the truth. Only then I, as a whistleblower, can form and express a concrete opinion and position. But just the same, she says, there are questions he must answer. And here they go. Question number one. These are questions she would ask Mr. Snowden to come forward and respond to truthfully. What was your foremost intention for making the decision to obtain thousands of documents that implicated the United States government? Question two. What was your foremost intention for actually taking the action following your decision and obtaining those documents? Question three. At the time when you were obtaining the documents, did you target particular categories of implicating documents, or did you just grab everything you could? A. If you vetted the documents or the specific categories of documents beforehand and then went about obtaining them, then why would you ask journalists to vet and make personal judgments on which ones to release or which ones to withhold permanently? If you didn't vet the documents prior to obtaining them, and if you asked particular journalists to vet them and decide what to release and what to withhold, did you make any demands to ensure that you were part of that vetting process and that they had to have your consent? If you didn't vet the documents prior to obtaining them, and if you asked particular journalists to vet them and decide what to release and what to withhold, did you also ask them to have meetings with U.S. and U.K. government agencies and have those who were actually implicated in your documents call the shots on what to withhold and what to release? This is deep. Question four. Did you provide Glenn Greenwald with your explicit consent and authorization to make decisions on what to release and what to withhold? If so, was this in writing? If so, why and how did you make that decision? For example, Mr. Greenwald entered in a contractual agreement with a mainstream corporate publisher to withhold certain documents only to include them exclusively in his coming book in return for millions of dollars. Did you sanction this decision? Do you find this action justified and reasonable? Question five. Did you provide Mr. Greenwald with your explicit consent to strike a business venture with a corporation that is a known cooperative partner of the NSA in a $250 million deal? Did you provide Mr. Greenwald to withhold, sorry, did you authorize Mr. Greenwald to withhold 99% of the documents and transfer their ownership to the corporate news entity owned by PayPal's Pierre Omidyar? If yes, when and how did you provide your consent and approval? What was your reasoning for sanctioning and or authorizing this transfer of document ownership and to withhold the vast majority of these documents from the public and its right to know? Question 6. Do you believe it is reasonable, justified, and acceptable that the person you gave the ownership of these documents to is commoditizing and profiting from these documents that are considered classified and stolen by the United States government, yet were considered by you as evidence to which the people have the right to know about? If yes, then do you believe that it is acceptable and correct for entities who obtain classified and incriminating government documents to market these documents as commodities and offer them to the highest bidders, whether the bidder is a government or a corporation or a book publisher? If your answer to the above question is yes, then do you believe you are also entitled to benefit and profit from the sale and censorship of these documents? All right. Question 7. Have you made any venture deals or entered into any contract with Mr. Greenwald where you will receive a cut from the millions of dollars that are being obtained by him in return for publication and withholding certain portions of the NSA documents? If yes, when, where, and how? If yes, then does your flexibility on the sale and commoditization of stolen and classified government documents also extend to foreign government entities? And question 8. This appears to be the first case labeled and categorized as a whistleblowing case where a leak is being commoditized at a value of hundreds of millions of dollars by corporations such as PayPal, book publishers, and Hollywood studios. Could you provide us with your general stand, principles, and values with regard to leaking and disclosing for political and profit motives? Hello, Mr. Snowden. Just 8 questions. And what did I say at the beginning? There are way too many questions that have gone unanswered about this guy. And there's something here that just isn't right. And it continues that Mr. Snowden is only the one talking about what, you know, other people should do, and you land, you crash land on the government now, and now you create a headache. You create, you know, you spawn political uproar, because now the people of Brazil, by your brash act of deciding, well, hey, You're so big and bad, you're going to put the president of Brazil in her place, and you are going to sandbag her. You're going to make her now have to explain herself one way or the other, because now it has become a political issue. And that is the mark, ladies and gentlemen, of somebody who should not be trusted. When you are willing to throw an entire nation, and this is the largest one in South America, when you believe yourself so entitled to do something like this and act like you Putin, you know, Putin can do it because, you know, well, he's got a huge country behind him, you have nothing, and you believe you can do the same thing. So you're doing an end run. You don't have to talk to Dilma, as you call her, the way you probably called your help by their first name. You don't have to talk to her. You can talk at her. And you can, you know, stir. You can stir the elements within to get what you want. And I have no doubt whatsoever that this particular president's decision to remove, this is now a huge decision economically. This is a huge hit to the technocracy that built these systems, to remove them outside of the United States and construct your own infrastructure, which you control from Brazil. That's what she decided. And therefore, there are people like Snowden, there are people like Greenwald and all these other folks, the technocrats, can smell money. This is now a multi-billion dollar enterprise that is going to happen. And yet everybody talks about Snowden in reverential terms. You shouldn't ask any questions of this guy. Well, here's a woman who founded the whistleblowers organization, the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. Check it out yourself. The website is titled BoilingFrogsPost.com. BoilingFrogsPost.com. I direct you there and read her entries, and you would see for yourself. This is her third blistering account, and the first one that I have read so far that says that the property that Snowden stole from the NSA is now part and parcel, is at the epicenter of a multi-million dollar business venture. And nobody, I have not seen this anywhere being discussed. I haven't seen it anywhere being discussed. But I endorse this. I think these are great questions. These are eight great questions. And as soon as he could answer them, I would like him to go now to any paper and answer these questions. Since you're so good at writing newspapers. But ladies and gentlemen, this is how people do things to create instability in a country. You have no reason. You are not entitled to any special consideration at all. You are a fugitive and you are on the run. But it doesn't matter to you what kind of havoc you create in a country that shouldn't even be wasting 1 minute of their time on you. You have no history of involvement in activism at all. And nobody's asking questions. And we all know why. We all know why. So, when you have a chance, go to BoilingFrogsPost.com. I highly recommend that you read it yourself, just in case I didn't read it right. You will read it. Let your own eyeballs read it. And you will see that I'm not the only one asking these questions. And I had from the very beginning, because this smells to the high heavens. It really does. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. I thank you. And I thank you for reaching out to me on leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook. Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Thanks. Bye-bye.